Acclaimed historian Julian Zelizer offers a deep examination of the role of partisanship in American democracy in his new book, In Defense of Partisanship, challenging the conventional wisdom that views political divisions as harmful. Zelizer argues that partisanship, when practiced constructively, is essential for advancing meaningful policy changes and safeguarding democratic values. He shows how ideological clashes have propelled transformative reforms and galvanized public engagement. The book looks to redefine the narrative around partisanship, urging readers to embrace its potential as a force for accountability, representation, and progress. Julian is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, a CNN political analyst, and a contributor to NPR's Here and Now. It's a great pleasure to welcome Julian Zelizer back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me. It's always nice to be back.
What brought you to partisanship? Because I guess I thought I knew more about it than I did until I read the book. It seems like it's something that is woefully lacking. And yet, why was it something that you said, okay, let's look at this in great detail?
Well, I think there's two answers. One is I started my career many decades ago when I first taught at the University at Albany, studying a Southern Democrat in the 1960s who was a powerful congressperson. And at that time, bipartisanship was really the problem in American politics. Many people were frustrated that a bipartisan alliance of Southern conservatives and Democrats in Congress constantly frustrated progress. They were gridlock. Bipartisanship was the problem. So I kind of came of age intellectually, never being totally on board with the idea bipartisanship is the cure-all. And at that time, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, many reformers wanted a more partisan political system. And the second is today, there's almost no complaint as frequent on both sides of the aisle, frankly, ironically enough, that partisanship is the problem in American politics. And whenever I hear something enough, I usually get curious to really think historically if that's the case and to also look at the value of what is being targeted.
It does seem, though, that logic would tell you that to have, if there are two sides, and usually there are many more, but if there are two sides, that they have a hand in something and they are working together as opposed to one group pushing solidly through the other. So what is it about partisanship that you think is underrated?
Well, the first is I do believe we have big differences in the country on pretty fundamental issues from reproductive rights to economic policy. And I think it's important that within the political system, those views are representative. And when partisanship is done well, I call responsible partisanship, I think parties are the best mechanisms we have and the mechanisms we will have pragmatically for some time to come to reflect those differences and to fight for them in Congress and in Washington. And also equally important is we have this incredibly disjointed, fragmented political system by design. And historically, since the founding, parties have been really important at offering a mechanism that connects the different branches and creates conversations about policy ideas and political decisions all the way down to the local level. So, and finally, I would just add one other thing. Parties produce big ideas at key moments in American politics. You look at any key kind of period like the New Deal, the Great Society, Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, parties are the engines for those moments of change. So on all three fronts, I think partisanship has actually been a important part of our democracy. And I talk in the book about distinguishing between hyper-partisanship, which we've seen the last couple of decades, which I think is very problematic, and what I call responsible partisanship, which we've had for much of American history.
Let us focus on the latter, which is the idea of responsible partisanship. What makes a type of partisanship to be responsible? What makes it responsible?
Well, in a nutshell, in our day and age, it's partisanship with guardrails in terms of what parties are willing to say, what procedures are considered fair game in political combat, and partisan leaders who balance the demands of partisan power, which will always and have always been American part of American politics, with other obligations of politics, governing, as well as kind of maintaining the health of our political institutions. If you have leaders who operate in that sphere, which I think generally we've had until the 1990s, the partisanship doesn't become utterly destructive, and it can actually be a source of productivity. Often strong parties are the best chance of reaching deals because parties can bring along their members in a way messy bipartisan coalitions can't always do.
So, where do we start to go off the rails from responsible partisanship to hyperpartisanship?
Well, I trace it and I draw on the work of many social scientists to the 1980s and 90s. And I do argue that there's been an asymmetry. I think Democrats generally, in terms of the leadership and the main voices of the party, have acted in pretty traditional ways, and I can talk about why. Republicans, I start with Newt Gingrich, his rise to power in the 1980s and 90s, who was very explicit about this idea of a no guardrail approach to partisanship, start to change dramatically during his speakership. We see it in the House of Representatives in the 1990s, such as normalizing government shutdowns as a tactic in political combat, as they did the Republicans with Bill Clinton. We fast forward to the Tea Party, which used mechanisms such as raising the debt ceiling all of a sudden as a way to accomplish political goals, literally threatening to send the country into default over budget disputes, and culminating in the president-elect Trump during his first term, who I think brought a lot of this together, not simply in abandoning traditional governing norms, but also in a willingness to say absolutely anything. And so he was a culmination of a multi-decade product where you saw this hyper-partisanship really grip the Republican Party.
Julian Zelizer is our guest. The name of the new book is In Defense of Partisanship, and it is a Columbia Global Report. Give us an idea of in the book you include many reforms that you believe need to be made so that we can return to responsible partisanship. Give us a sense of what you have there. I know, I mean, it's an interesting list, beginning with repealing the filibuster.
Yeah, so this is the most novel part of the writing for me. I'm a historian, so I usually end at the moment we're about to move forward. But I did want to think about it, and it's a different kind of book. So I make several recommendations. One is to think about the most destructive procedures that we've had, procedures that have really become akin to weapons of mass destruction, but in Washington on Capitol Hill. One, I to say we I think eliminating the debt ceiling, which is not a constitutional procedure, is quite important, and the arguments in favor now have widespread support. And you should take I believe taking that away would be quite useful and eliminate one of the most dangerous things we've seen in the last few years. I think the filibuster, and I know there's debates about this, generally has really been a tool of obstruction and for this kind of partisanship that you just stifle progress on absolutely anything. And either eliminating it or certainly reforming it, which we've done many times, including on Supreme Court nominees, would take away one of the tools that parties have used. So I outlined some procedures that I think would be important. I also talk about trying to think more carefully about integrating parties. And I mean by that, integrating the connections that bond leaders and average citizens, and using new technology, new kinds of town hall computer programs to really create stronger connections between the grassroots and the national leadership so that people don't feel partisanship is something happening in Washington as opposed to something connected to them. I also talk, by the way, about something abstract, but it's essential. It's a kind of leadership, a leadership that isn't just about transforming ideas or bargain dealing, making deals and bargaining, but leaders that pay attention to norms and reestablish the importance of these guardrails in their politics.
You write about Citizens United, the Citizens United decision in the book, and obviously that's something that you you can't snap your fingers and overturn. But you do talk about restoring the campaign finance rules that came undone as a result of that decision.
It's very important. I do think, you know, partisanship and campaign finance are connected in that there's a lot of organizations out there. They're single issue organizations. They tend to align with one party or the other. And now they just flood the system with money. And most legislators, senators, and members of the House are not going to depart very far from sources of donations, which they need to run their campaigns, to avoid challengers. So I think undercutting that connection would actually be important to mitigating some of the partisan tensions that members face in terms of a hyper-partisan mentality. It's also a great way, the new kind of focus in campaign finance isn't curbing all donations and some system of public finance, but encouraging small donations, creating incentives for a person to donate $5, $10, and then matching that money so that candidates think about that more seriously. And a lot of cities have done this and some states. And I think that's a really good idea because, again, it would weaken some of the pressure from big single issue donors, which I think is important to hyperpartisanship. And at the same time, it serves that mechanism. When someone gives $5 or $10, they feel more connected to politics. So I think those reforms are quite interesting and very realistic. They're happening. It's not some imagined solution that might be good in the future.
With that said, though, this is going to be a hard sell in the future, right? I mean, we're in a place where top Republicans are saying that they're not going to give money to the city of Los Angeles in fire aid because of their poor behavior. So that's hyper-partisanship, and that doesn't seem like it's going anywhere anytime soon.
It's not. And look, the point of a book like this, it's not journalism. So meaning it's not about what to do tomorrow or what to do next
right.
week. The whole point of writing this for me intellectually is to step back and really think about this problem or this solution, meaning partisanship, and offer a guide to what we need to do to move it to a better place based on what we've done in the past. And so you're right. And that is a problem. That is exactly the kind of partisanship, irresponsible partisanship that we have. And I don't know what to do in the next few weeks. I don't think it's going to go away. And part of the argument is this has now been building for 2-3 decades. It's not just out of nowhere. And we really need to undertake some pretty serious reforms and nurture new kinds of leaders if we're going to move away from this.
The American people obviously went to the polls in November, and they had a fairly, we can argue about this, but a fairly clear choice in whether voting for Kamala Harris would have brought back the type of partisanship that you're looking for. I'm not sure that that is the case, but it certainly was voting for hyper-partisanship in the election of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. What does that say about the electorate?
I think a lot of the electorate, half of it is certainly fine with this. I think it's a party problem, not simply an issue involving one leader, and it won't change anytime soon. I think 2024 really was an affirmation that the style of Republican politics that President-elect Trump has turned to, despite everything he did, despite what happened in 2020, is okay. And for a lot of the rest of the electorate, they don't support it, but they're living with it.
Right.
So I think the election in many ways reflects some of the issues we need to contend with if we're going to have a serious conversation about trying to make this system more palatable and more constructive, frankly, in terms of how Washington works.
Give me your sense of the current state of what bipartisanship looks like now and how it compares to a partisanship that you would like to see.
Bipartisanship is more sporadic and more fleeting, obviously. We do have bipartisan deals. It's not a binary. I mean, I know that's the pressure. So you can have both, and I think we have it, but it's still rare. I think we have more bipartisanship in Congress on small issues, on kind of small items that come and we don't pay attention to. But on big questions, immigration, climate change, and more, we've seen over and over again how bipartisanship is just very difficult. And it's not simply a structural problem. There's also just disagreement over what to do. So bipartisanship is simply not a huge norm as it had been in the 1950s and 60s. Centralized parties really are the dominant source of power in Washington and both in the House and Senate at this time. And I argue that usually Democrats have better luck, or they're better at controlling some of the inner demons of partisanship. And they're still working within these traditional forms of governing, and they don't take the steps we see, as we saw with the Tea Party and the debt ceiling. So that's where it is right now. But if you're looking at what's the dominant mode of governing for since the 90s, it's been a partisan era.
So you said a moment ago that this is a party problem, and I'm just the Republicans don't seem to care about the image that they have of that they embrace that hyperpartisanship that the Democrats do not seem to as much. Not that they are not without fault, but I'm curious as to what brings that idea to a party that it is something that its members become comfortable with.
I mean, some of it is it's worked, and so it becomes an endless cycle. If it works, keep doing it because you keep amassing power. Part of it is, look, Democrats remain a party about government. It's central to their broader platform, using government to alleviate different problems. Whereas Republicans, since Reagan, have moved away from that. Government is the problem. And so if you're a party that doesn't really care about government quite the same way, you're willing to live with gridlock. You're willing to live with obstruction because it's actually it's congruent with your philosophy. Let the markets do things, whereas Democrats just can't afford that. So they're always going to be limited on what they want to do. So it's partly power, partly philosophical, and partly leadership. I don't want to discount the impact, for example, of President-elect Trump and his willingness to just legitimate all out this kind of vision of how partisanship should be done. And in the Congress, we've seen the same thing with first Tea Party Republicans and now what people are calling the MAGA Republican generation.
You touched on this, but I would like to go back to it. And bring us to the 1950s and 1960s, where you talk in the book about how responsible partisanship, for want of a better term, a golden age of responsible partisanship. Give us a sense of that, of what we could possibly go back to.
Yeah, I mean, I often think, look, Republicans and Democrats, even in an era with a lot of bipartisanship, could be really tough, and go after each other. But you think of a case like Senator Joe McCarthy. He was a renegade. He was in many ways comparable to what we sometimes or often see today, saying anything, disinformation, willing to really twist up processes we count on for political purposes. But in the end, the Republican Party, his party, pushed back against that. They understood that he was an outlier. They did not consider him to be a future leader of the party. And ultimately, with a censure in 1954 and with informal political pressure, including from the White House, it took too long. But finally, the party did act. That's responsible partisanship. A second example would simply be That certain kind of items that today are common, like the filibuster, were not used all the time. Most legislation in the 50s and 60s were not subject to a filibuster. High profile legislation like civil rights was, but it wasn't just the normal tool of combat. There was an understanding that most of the time you had to reach decisions and you had to reach agreement. Obstruction was not an end in itself. So those are two ways you look at the 50s and 60s. It looks like a very different political landscape.
So, talking about two ways to look at things, for you as a historian, as you said, you usually just go up to this point and then stop without looking forward. But as you look at a new administration coming in, is this fascinating to you? Are you fascinated by what could happen over the next 4 years, or just dreading it?
No, I'm fascinated by it. And even the parts that concern me greatly, and they do cause me concern, only create an incentive for me personally to study it more, to try to talk about it more. I mean, that's what I have devoted my whole life to. And it is a critical moment in the democracy. And I think some people have just, that you hear more people say they are tuning out. You can't really tune out because Washington won't tune out. And so for me, I feel more energized in some ways. I'm excited this book comes out now, not simply because the book is out and I'm proud of working on it, but these are the conversations we have to have, the fundamentals about what's going on and how the process is working, as well as the potential risks and dangers we see in the next 4 years. So that's how I think about it. And I always connect it to the past. I mean, that is just how I see things because of my disciplinary training, but I'm trying to understand them, and I try as best I can to offer some explanation and some context to people, citizens today who are interested in a deeper understanding than what happened, a minute ago,
Right.
in our politics.
The name of the new book is In Defense of Partisanship. It is published by Columbia Global Reports. Julian Zelizer, it's always a great pleasure and honor to have you on the program. I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
Be well. Thanks so much. Again, the name of the new book is In Defense of Partisanship, published by Columbia Global Reports. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.